Hello and welcome to episode 24 of Leadership Amplified. It's great to have your company. Leadership Amplified inspires leaders to get more impact with their teams, to promote inclusion, and to make leadership more satisfying. It's designed for high-achieving leaders who aspire to do well and who want to do well by their teams and their organizations. The podcast showcases exemplary leaders and thought leaders, and it introduces frameworks and tools that make leadership both easier and more satisfying. In 2022, I'm focusing on four major themes: flexible work, well-being, influence, and focus, in particular, organizing, prioritizing, and digitizing to get meaningful work done. My guest today is Mark Butler. And he's an accredited clinical psychotherapist with 14 years' experience in the field. He focuses on mindset and mental well-being at work, mentoring people through adverse issues around workplace burnout, stress, anxiety, and unrelated unhealthy coping strategies. Mark understands burnout and executive exhaustion so well because he's been there. And those experiences inform his work with individuals, teams, and organizations. He's keen to develop sustainable and effective work practices. Mark's knowledge and experiences underpinned his drive and passion for pursuing effective recovery and resilience programs to get employees back on track and performing at their optimum level. His practice is built around belonging and our fundamental human need to feel safe. Mark's work, from organizations through to individuals, orbits around belonging and psychological safety. He has two master's degrees in the mental health field and is sought after for his expertise in aligning productivity and well-being at work. Before his clinical career, Mark spent 25 years in senior management roles, working in international and Australian corporations such as Village Roadshow and Virgin Australia, as well as with small to medium enterprises and not-for-profit organisations. So, hi, Mark. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to the podcast. Thanks very much for joining me, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation today.
Oh, me too, Karen. Thanks so much for asking me. I've been looking forward to this, I have to say.
Oh, that's great. Okay, and we certainly share a number of interests, and really looking forward to the focus that we've chosen for the conversation today, which is on burnout. We'd rather not be talking about it, but unfortunately, we need to,
It's a
even more
sad
these
fact of life.
days.
Yeah, exactly. It really is.
But before we get stuck into that part of the conversation, tell us a bit about yourself and how you got to be doing the sort of work you do now. I mean, obviously, you've talked about your own experience of burnout, but that's not everything about you. Tell us about you.
Well, you can tell from my accent that I wasn't born in Australia. I'm an import. I came here in the late 80s, emigrated over, and I started working with Virgin, Richard Branson's arm, when he had film and television studios back in those days. And so most of my career was then in that sort of film distribution, television programming distribution onto DVD, that sort of thing. For God, more years than I can count, probably about 25 years or so. And as part of that, I've worked with major international studios. I've worked with and run sort of independent studios here as well in Australia. So that was kind of my corporate sort of experience. So it was quite broad working, pardon me, working in retail, working with the retail market, working with the television markets, etc. Great industry, great fun, very fast paced, I found. And part of it became a reason, one of my reasons for burning out, a good many years ago, probably sort of early mid 2000s, somewhere in and around there. And so I experienced a level of burnout then, and it was really interesting because what I found was I didn't see it coming. Other people saw it coming in me. And yeah. I now know, if I knew then what I know now, it would have been a very different outcome, I think. But, you know.
Yeah, we can all say that.
Yeah, right. But I was concerned about the my people's level of stress and overwhelm. And held myself to a higher standard. Very, very common in leadership roles.
Yeah.
I should be able to manage this. I should be able to do this. And it was actually, and I tell this story quite openly, it was coming out of a meeting, a marketing director came to me and she said, "Look, don't worry, it's just film, it's all right." And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Maybe you should go to the bathroom and just check yourself." So I did, and I went into the bathroom, and I almost didn't recognize myself.
Really?
I was white, I was trembling, I was sweating profusely. Could have been tears, could have been sweat, could, you know. But the overriding point is I had absolutely no idea that it was going on. So this was my bodily response to burnout, just had enough. And I've subsequently found and met with and talked with a good number of people who found exactly the same thing. And so we do now know that it's very likely that we will make every excuse under the sun for our own reactions to burnout. And it takes somebody else seeing it in us and having the courage to have the conversation with us about it. I think that's hugely important to sort of bridge that gap, if you like. And then the other thing I've subsequently found is if you have experienced burnout, you are more susceptible to it again in the future. So lightning will strike twice.
Yep.
But if you need a silver lining for that, it's that you're going to spot it coming a lot sooner. And you will see it in yourself. You know, and you should see it in yourself this second time around. But as part of all of that, it fascinated me. And I decided to sort of drill a bit deeper, and I started looking at studying mental health. And because I'd had it in a history of well, it was diagnosed as depression when I was a young kid, like 10 years of age. I was very ill for a while. Because back then, I'm in my mid 50s now. So back then, 10 year old kids didn't get anxiety. It was housewives got anxiety and nobody else kind of thing. Right. So it was diagnosed as depression, but it turns out it was anxiety, but the symptoms and the treatments are so similar to both of those quite often that actually, you know, it kind of didn't matter so much as long as I got the treatment sort of thing. So, But I think that played into it. So that made me a bit more susceptible to it. So I went and studied mental health on the premise of it sort of being giving back to society kind of thing. I never envisaged it becoming a career.
Okay. So it was more about personal interest. This has happened to me. I want to know more about it rather than it's time for a career change.
Exactly right. And and I just followed my nose and I became more and more interested in it. And next thing you know, I was in a master's degree course in psychotherapy and I had to get my clinical hours up. And I ended up working with people who were in deep in addiction and substance use challenges. Mm-hmm. Like the ones who would be in 12-month rehab sort of programs. So right down the sharp end. And I think what fascinated me about that was I was working with and dealing with and talking to people who had lost kind of everything, but still clung on and still wanted to get better. And so the motivation there was enormous. Mm-hmm. And we were able to do great work and we saw sort of rapid changes and you know what I mean? And that interested me a great deal more because I thought it's so removed from the corporate life, which was still going on, by the way.
Yes.
This was kind of my hobby, what you'd probably call a side hustle now, except it wasn't paid. And it was all pro bono work. And then I moved up to the Northern Rivers and I got involved in veterans with post-traumatic stress and substance use.
Mm-hmm.
And started to see how we weren't doing as well as we could in treating and dealing with that.
Mm.
And so that embarked on a 7-year program. I ended up doing another master's degree while I was doing that, and developing treatment models and treatment programs for veterans of PTSD. And it still wasn't my career. So
this is still your side hustle.
These are my hobbies, right?
Yeah.
These became my hobbies. But what I experienced then at the end of all of that was, I'm the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. And we're waiting for all of this sort of stuff to happen. And I thought, we can be a fence around the top of the cliff. And then I heard this wonderful poem from 1895 by a guy called Joseph Malins. And the last line of the poem is, better put a fence around the top of the cliff than an ambulance down in the valley. And I thought, oh, wow, that really spoke to me.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, 1895 must be a typo. Ambulances in 1895? I did a little, you know, thank God for Google. And ambulances have been around since like Spanish wars in the medieval times, the 12th, 13th century. So yeah. I thought, oh, right, okay. Well, he was right then. And so that sort of led me to explore, why are we waiting as the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff?
Very good question.
Isn't it? And I looked at the health budget, the health expenditure here in Australia. 1.34% of our health budget is spent in prevention. And I thought, that sounds pitifully small. And it is. It's about a third to a half of what comparable countries. Comparable countries like New Zealand, the UK, Canada, even the US spend on their health budgets. And I mean, to put it in context, 30% of the health budget is spent in the last 6 months of life. Now, I'm not saying don't spend now, but that number is going to get bigger as we age and we live longer, etc. But it can have an effect. What we spend in prevention can have a significant effect on what we spend further on down the line.
Absolutely.
So there's a real value for us as society to have a prevention strategy. But I thought for businesses and organizations, there's a real, real, real value in it. There's a return on that investment that needs to be looked at in a much broader picture rather than waiting to deal with issues that have already occurred.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I started. So that's shifted my career now into that space.
Absolutely.
Because the clinical background, the corporate background, been there, done that in the sort of lived experience. And that's what I advocate, looking at that. Because the other thing with budget, the health budget, we spend about 2% on mental health. Now, we measure the burden of disease. That's how, these things are measured to determine what effect issues have on the overall sort of health, public health. Because the thing with mental health is you don't die young from it, mostly, right? They're not, schizophrenia can, dementia can age people by a few years, but it's not like things like cancer or cardiovascular issues. And so you can live a long, long time with mental health issues. So they don't look at sort of disability years lost. They look at the burden of disease on society. That's how it's measured. And mental health is about 14% of the burden of disease, but we spend about 2% on it.
Yeah.
Right. So there's not enough going on at the top of the cliff. We're all just waiting for the ambulance.
That's right. I have to say that I think that has probably improved. I started my career as a psychologist working in community health, doing preventative work and very much swimming against the tide. So you're seeing hymn book, that whole focus on getting the resources and helping people to prevent, longer term, ill health and to get mental health into the conversation was very difficult, and it remains so. I mean, one of the things I have been quite pleased to see is, as a consequence of COVID and the concern raised about the impact on mental health, that we are seeming to take it somewhat seriously. And organisations like, you know, Black Dog and Beyond Blue have done a lot to raise awareness around the importance of mental health and how it impacts so many people. But, you know, at that preventative stage, there isn't necessarily a whole lot you have to do, and you don't necessarily need a whole lot of resources, but it's about acknowledging and taking some action and helping people to learn what they can do to better, you know, manage their emotions and the impact of life on them.
Exactly. And, you know, I think you're spot on when you say COVID has started the conversation of what wasn't a nice to have conversation to now a need to have. And I think it's the first time we've had, I believe, five generations in the workplace, each one with a different sort of approach to what, you know, what mental health needs might be. And there's, you know what I mean? And they're quite disparate. There's quite a large shift between them. So I think it's important that we do have the conversations and normalize it and reduce stigma. It's got to start. It's got to start there, you know.
It's a big ask,
but I think we're getting there. Generationally, we're getting there. The employee value proposition needs to address that we do have your overall health in mind, you know, and psychological safety. You know, even that's gone beyond just being safe to innovate now, and it covers a much wider gamut.
Yeah. All so that's great. Stuff. Yes. Mm. In terms, I mean, there's a lot more we could talk about in terms. There's a lot more that we could talk about in terms of, you know, your background and your experience and how you got to here. Just the last thing I'd like to ask you is about that moment when you made the decision to give up corporate life.
Yeah.
And throw yourself into this sideline that you'd had for however many years, or quite a few.
Yeah.
What made you finally make the jump?
Look, there wasn't an aha moment in it. I just think it wasn't a generativity thing. It wasn't me looking for my legacy, what I'm going to leave behind. It wasn't anything like that. I just think the more I researched and the more I looked at how we can do so much more for veterans. And I realized we, you know, for workplaces, for people in general, we can do so much more. Mm. COVID then came along and I thought this has really shifted, you know, and there's an opportunity now to reach out and see what we can do to shift the kind of mindset around mindset, if you like.
Yes, the mindset around mindset. Okay.
Yeah.
Great. So let's talk about that then. Let's get stuck in.
Sure.
Let's talk about that then. Let's get stuck into what's happening in the field of burnout, the sort of, I guess, the challenges you're seeing and the opportunities that might come out of the increased focus on burnout.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things that I'm noticing. You know, anybody who's involved in the whole burnout sort of space has heard of Christy Maslach and the Maslach Burnout Inventory, which is the sort of gold standard, has been for a long, long time. And the World Health Organization's interpretation of burnout, when they first kind of shifted what they had to say about it, people thought, oh, it's a diagnosis now, so it's a mental health condition. And it's not. It's a phenomenon that we can experience in the workplace as one area where we can experience it. It's not the only one. But the World Health Organization's definition that ties in with the Maslach Burnout Inventory, and that is three main areas of burnout that they consider. And one of those is exhaustion, which you would kind of get. You'd understand that. And we can break exhaustion down to physical, mental, and emotional exhaustion. And sometimes it's the first thing you'll see. Not necessarily, though. There's another area of burnout where they refer to cynicism. And by cynicism, what they're sort of saying is, how you'll notice it is people in your teams speaking disparagingly about the organization, about their leaders, about their peers, or it can get very dangerous when they start talking about your customers or clients in that sort of way. Now, there's a few things going on here when we're hearing that cynical sort of gossipy kind of conversation. If somebody's in that space, they've kind of had that, you know, they're sort of getting, I wouldn't say necessarily at the end of the line, but they're fed up. They've kind of had enough. But it's a lonely place to be. And so sometimes that conversation is a way of recruiting somebody else into where they're at. So mm-hmm. that's where you'll hear it in that sort of gossipy way in the workplace. But also it's another way for people to validate what they're feeling. Right. So it can. So that sort of cynicism can kick in. If they don't feeling valued, they're not feeling heard, etc. But there's a third element that is they talk about efficacy. So in other words, our ability to do our job. And you could be the most passionate person, love your job, love your role, you're burning out, but your ability to do great work starts to slip away. That was one of mine. What I noticed was I couldn't remember the names of people I was working with every day. Spoke to somebody a few days ago, they lost the ability to spell. You know, they were trying to write the word picnic, and it was P-I-C-K-N-I-C-K, and they were staring at it and couldn't figure it out. Can simple arithmetic escapes, reading an email five times. And that's not because you don't care anymore. It's just the brain fog that kicks in. So that's been the traditional view, those sorts of three pillars, if you like. And but there was always something missing for me in that. Because nowhere in there is there a mention of mental health per se, like anxiety or depression or the sorts of things that sort of, that, you know, that can manifest. And people sometimes think that they can go to a GP and get a diagnosis of burnout. And of course you can't, it's a phenomenon. You can have symptoms that occur as a result of it that you can sort of be, treated for as such. So burnout was still that sort of mystical thing we didn't really sort of know too much about. But Gordon Parker, I think it is, wrote a book recently. Yeah, he started Black Dog Institute, and he's an emeritus professor, I think, University of New South Wales. Wrote a book recently on burnout with a couple of colleagues. Fabulous book, really, really good. And they did start to talk about the sort of mental health challenges. They specified them. There's about 12 criteria, I think, in their model. Pardon me. But I'm delighted to say, and we're able to talk about sort of what we call affect issues, things that sort of affect our mood and affect our emotions, which now can finally be part of the burnout conversation as well. So I'm really pleased with that, I think. So we've, when I talk about it, I talk about exhaustion. I don't talk about efficacy. I talk about ability because I think it's more easily recognized. I talk about affect. And then I talk about cynicism, much more apathy. Cynicism, I think, is kind of pushing outwards and lashing out at everything that's going on for me. Apathetic can be sort of, I've just had enough of all of this, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's a more encompassing thing that to my mind, typifies issues of burnout, if you like.
Yeah. And I think it's important to make the distinction there, just so that kind of listeners don't think people who are ordinarily apathetic aren't necessarily suffering from burnout, or those people. I mean, we all probably have come across people who are just relentlessly cynical. And so this, you know, in terms of burnout, it's when people are ordinarily not cynical. That they are real contributors and are more enthusiastic about their work, but they suddenly, with the burnout and the other couple of criteria, they tip into that feeling of cynicism. And I think that's partly bewildering. But otherwise great performers, it can be very challenging to feel yourself being cynical.
Well, I think you become very demoralized when you're trying to give it your best shot. You know you're tired. You know you're sort of coming to the end of your rope, if you like. And you're really, really trying very, very hard. And you just don't have the ability to do your best work.
Yeah.
That's going to happen. Yeah. You're just going to reach a point where you go, I can't do this. Yeah. No, we're in that sort of, you know, apathy. So,
So tell us, given your focus on prevention, great focus to have. What can organizations be doing to prevent this? I mean, they couldn't prevent COVID.
So sorry.
That's okay. For the listener's point of view, Mark has been very courageous and is pushing through a bout of bronchitis. So if you're hearing the occasional cough there in the background, that's because he's soldiering on. And that's not necessarily something we will always advocate, Mark, is it?
No, it's not. And I'm a huge advocate for self-care, but I'm also an advocate for, I was so enthused about coming on and having having this podcast that I pushed myself probably. I'm glad I did.
I do appreciate it. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So what organizations can do to prevent burnout?
Yeah. You know, a very interesting conversation can be had when we raise Jennifer Moss in Harvard Business Review. She said, and I'll paraphrase this, because I'm sure I won't get it exactly right, but she said work-related burnout is not a people problem, it's an organizational problem. And I love that. Now, you can have the philosophical conversation and say, well, what is an organization but the sum of its people? But I think that might be a little bit reductionist, because there are systems in place and there are processes in place that occur that are sort of more than just the sum of the people. So in other words, I think we have to look at the dance and not just the dancers sometimes. Hmm. And so when somebody is burning out and it's work related, we have to look at work design. Now, I'm not an expert in work design by any means, but I do know what overload looks like, and I do know what overwhelm looks like. Hmm. And there's two sort of areas to this I like to talk about. In the prevention space, I think leaders need to be upskilled in what to look for and what to do about it when they see it. And the sort of metaphor, the analogy I like to use is, you're a team captain running onto the pitch. If a couple of your players are limping a little bit, you kind of need to be able to spot it, not wait until they're carried off the pitch, because now the gameplay has changed and we're not going to win, right? But neither are you a physio. At no point are you required to be the treater of somebody's challenge, but you can influence so much in how somebody approaches their own sorts of challenges by being supportive, creating a safe space. That's it. That's all you actually have to do. And I often talk about some research that's been conducted on sort of psychological treatments, if you like, going back probably 80 years or more. There's been so many different models on the efficacy or the value of or the likelihood of recovery from mental health treatment. And they kind of all boil down to these four main areas. And 40% of the likelihood of somebody getting better from a mental health issue is based on the community support that they get. So family, friends, but also workplace, right? 30% of the likelihood of getting better is based on their sense of hope that they can. So now we're at 70% of the likelihood of recovery, and we haven't even touched on, your primary care, your GP, your psychiatrist, your council worker, your psychologist, whoever it is. The relationship you have with them is valued at about 15% of the likelihood, but they can also influence your sense of hope. So there's not an exact line between these numbers, but the final 15% is the treatment that you get. Whether it's talk therapy or medication or hypnosis or whatever it is. But I say to leaders, you have the ability to influence as much as 70% of the likelihood of somebody getting better. And you're not treating anyone. You're not a counselor. You're not expected to save or rescue anybody. Just be able to see when something's not going right. See who's starting to limp when you're running onto the pitch. So that's the first thing, leaders being upskilled. And the best leaders are able to have those sorts of caring conversations with their people. But about 50% of leaders are actually uncomfortable doing it, and they're afraid to, what if I'm the problem? Or what if they become a burden on me? You know, I don't know what to say, so I'll tell them to go see HR, which is not HR's job, never was. The responsibility lies with you as a leader in the first place, in the first instance, at least.
Yeah. Yep. But I also think that one of the things that some leaders can do is, you know, it's about the boots they supply or the uniforms they supply.
Yes.
It's about whether they've measured out the field well, whether whether they've got, you know, the right kinds of nets, for example.
Yeah.
It's whether they give the right pep talk. So I think that great leaders can focus really on remediating and noticing and probably do that pretty well. And then individuals need to take responsibility for how they respond to things and what they do about them.
Yes.
But I do think that there's a proportion of organizations and a proportion of leaders that almost thrive on the sorts of demands that create burnout. You know, they're too competitive, overpromise, too hard on people, don't acknowledge, etc. And I just wonder, what proportion do you think of organizations are you seeing? What are those organizations actually doing to remediate that?
SafeWork Australia released some research that said 50% of businesses react to issues around mental health. And maybe, I think it was as many as 80% of organizations do not have a coordinated and sort of integrated mental health strategy for their people. Mm. Now, that is spread across large, medium, and small organizations. And, you know, we shouldn't assume that most of those are small, independent, sort of family type operations. Mm. It's not. It is across the board that people go, pardon me, people don't have that concentrated sort of effort, if you like. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes have to compare it with the analogy of, you know, this idea of having the canary in a cage down the coal mine, right? And the idea that was carbon monoxide was a poisonous gas down the coal mine, used to kill miners. Mm. Number one killer. And they had the great idea of bringing a canary in a cage down. The idea being, this is for your listeners who aren't aware of this analogy. Mm. The canary in a little cage, if there was anything toxic in the at the work, the coal face, the workplace, the canary would collapse first. So everybody kept an eye on the canary. And if the canary was at the bottom of the cage, everybody out. It's an unsafe workplace. Now, we don't have carbon monoxide today, but when I'm working with teams and working with organizations, I do like to use that analogy and then ask them, what is your carbon monoxide, do you think? What makes your workplace toxic? Because like carbon monoxide, it doesn't trigger any senses. You can't smell it, taste it, feel it, hear it, see it, any of that. And whatever is your carbon monoxide today will be the same. Mm-hmm. And so I ask, what is it? And usually the answer is going to be stress, workload, work design, something like that, right? It's never, I'm not a strong enough canary. It's something that's down the coal mine, something toxic at the workplace. And so then I say, okay, well, assuming each one of you then has your own canary, what's your canary? How do you know when you're approaching overwhelm? Because down the coal mine, if they saw the canary collapsing, everybody out. Today, we see a canary collapsing, we don't do anything about it. Until enough canaries have collapsed, and then we say, oh, we need stronger canaries. Right? Yeah,
exactly.
Which isn't the answer.
Why do we have so much burnout?
So the solution isn't get stronger canaries or, you know, get people to build up their resilience or build up their self-care. That's part of it, absolutely. But we can't keep blaming the canaries for collapsing. There's got to be something else that needs to be done. And that is at the workplace.
Yeah.
And that's work design. And you know, I'm going to quote you from your book because I really enjoyed reading it. I'm sorry, Karen, but it's really, really, it's a very good point. And I think it's Cedal Neely was the person that said it. And you quoted him beautifully by saying, having control over when, where, and how you work matters a great deal because it signals trust and reliability. So we're tapping into autonomy, which is one of the great sort of rescuers of burnout, if you like, because that taps into people's passion. And, you know, there's a whole burnout is one sort of area. Bore out is a whole other psychological issue, which is and what it is when we're sort of underwhelmed by our job.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure there'll be people listening who have gone for jobs and they were told, oh, you're overqualified for this. And I've heard it before and I've said, so let me be the judge of that. But really, their problem is you won't be challenged. You'll get bored. You'll get lazy. You'll get apathetic. You'll be bored. You'll get bore out. That's really what it is, you know, and which can lead to anxiety and depression and all of the other sorts of mental health challenges as well. So we need to be passionate about what we're doing, but we need to have some sort of sense of control over how we do it.
Yeah,
that's you know, and that's hugely important. And it's just one of the many things I lifted from your book. Sorry, I hope I haven't embarrassed you too much.
Now, I didn't interrupt. I took the conversation off on a track when you were talking about organizations. When you were talking about organizations, and there were two things that could be done, and you were talking about sort of work design and the what actually makes a difference.
Yeah.
To shifting work. So I stopped you, or I prevented you from getting to that second part. So why don't you go there now?
Oh, okay. Well, really what I was saying is that the two areas is upskilling leaders to be able to look for what's challenging the people. And then the second one really is around the work design.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's where it's at. And where I was then going to go was around, I think, that whole sort of idea of autonomy and that idea of having some sense of control. Because there's a sort of an intersection, I think, around autonomy, where trust and reliability has to come into safety, if you like. So safety for a leader to trust their people to be able to do the work that they need to do. And this is one of the other sort of joyful things that has come out of COVID. I think we've all earned our right to work from home badge. You know, I think we've proven that we're not all watching Dr. Phil in the afternoon and that we are actually, you know, able to do what we need to do. And I think there was a great lesson to be had because so many businesses survived based on their people taking the autonomous sort of steps to do whatever it is that needed to be done. It's a whole new way of working and it challenged a lot of people. It has led to some other sorts of mental health challenges, I think, sometimes. And in fact, even burnout that would not be work related. Things like people who were burning up because of a perfectionist sort of trait, you know, needing to know that what they're doing is good enough. And when you're working remotely, that's a bit more challenging to achieve. But you had other people who are having to deal with homeschooling and special needs kids or looking at caring for elderly, etc. There's a whole host of other areas that we don't have control or autonomy over that needed to be done, but has sort of led to stages of burnout, if you like, and the same sorts of symptoms.
Yeah. And even though traditionally they're not burnout, the thing is we are one individual, each individual. So everything accumulates, and whatever the source of the stress, at the end, you know, you've got a total amount of stress.
Yeah, that's right. Every single one of us has a breaking point. You know, we're like a violin string. You tighten it high enough and for long enough, it'll break. Every single one will. Every hard drive on our computer will fail. Every light bulb will fail. You know, so nobody's immune to it. It's just levels and degrees. And a lot of it can be based on what else is going on in your life, because we can't compartmentalize.
You know? If only we could sometimes, we think.
Oh, wouldn't it be lovely?
Yes, because then we wouldn't have any problem with the negative sides.
The negatives, yeah, exactly.
The negatives of stress, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, Mark, that's been a great conversation. What I wonder if we might do to wrap up the conversation is just hear from you in terms of the takeout lessons, whether it's about organizations or individuals or teams or leaders or whatever it might be, just in terms of how people might, you know, manage their burnout or help to manage burnout in others.
Yeah, look, for me, whenever I'm dealing with people in this space and they're burning out or they're burnt out, and I think Gordon Parker refers beautifully to this in his book on burnout. He said there's a difference how you look after a flickering candle versus how you look after a candle that's already blown out. Two very different approaches. And I think that's a lovely analogy.
Yeah.
And if we can get to things, if we can get to the flickering candle before it burns out, it's going to be a better result. But by no means does it mean one has to leave one's role or leave the job or leave the company even necessarily. I would always explore with somebody the possibility for maintaining as much normality as possible. But it comes back to caring for oneself, first of all. If the engine isn't running right, you're not going anywhere. So sleep, diet, exercise, mindset, I think sleep is probably the most important one and can be the most challenging, people lying awake at night, ruminating, etc.
Yeah.
But I think it's hugely important. And diet is huge. Actually, they're all, sleep, diet, and exercise are absolutely vital for a smooth running machine. The foundations. If we don't get that right, the rest of it, we're just kind of throwing mud at the wall kind of thing. I absolutely think work design and looking at workload and just having a conversation with your leader. Around what it's looking like and where you're facing challenges. I've worked with some teachers as an example who are burnt out. Now, there's not a whole lot you can do around changing the workload of a teacher. You know, they're either going to work 5 days a week or they might have to do 4 days a week or whatever it is. And there's not much you can do in terms of changing the role that they do. But what often works is to provide a passion project. So on Wednesdays, you're passionate about improving the reading, remedial reading or something like that. So for this term, Wednesdays, you're going to spend that time creating a new program for remedial reading for children, whatever it is. And that gives them some autonomy. It gives them some passion. And it gives them the ability to sort of bounce back and look after their sort of healthcare and self as well. So that's what individuals can do. Leaders can do a lot around upskilling themselves and knowing what to look for. Don't be afraid of the conversation. It's not a hard conversation. It's a caring one. It's always a good one.
Say that again, Mark. That's such an important message. Just repeat it.
So look, leaders, it's you might think it's a difficult conversation. It's not. It's actually a good one. Mm-hmm. Right? It's really, really hard to get it wrong. But here is the tip around that. If you're a leader, don't tell somebody what to do to get better. You're a leader. You think you're expected to know the answers. This is the one time when you're not. And if ever I'm going to get a tattoo, Karen, and I haven't yet, but if I ever do, it'll say, ask, don't tell. That'll be my mantra, right?
That's almost worth it.
Yeah, it's almost worth getting a tattoo just for that. Because it's, if we empower people in whatever it is they need, they're much more likely to buy in. And if we try and save them, what we're actually doing is we're not giving them choice. We're giving them a decision. It's a take it or leave it kind of thing.
Right. And enter the stress.
Absolutely. I'll take your workload and I'll give it to this person, but they could be their competition in the team. And now so their anxiety is twice as high because they think the next redundancy that comes along, I'm for the chop, right? Or the next promotion that comes along, I'm not going to get it. The other person will. So it doesn't resolve anything. So we give people choice, not a decision. So it's A, B, or C, and how can, or just ask, how can I help? What can we do to support you? And, if you ask for 2 weeks in Fiji, we probably can't accommodate that. But but if there's something that we can do to ease this journey for you, please let us know what it is. And there's no judgment. There is, this is not going to affect your career. Because if we deal with this with you as an individual now, a leader should be thinking, what I'll get is a sense of loyalty. I'll get a reputation of being a caring leader. And every leader's greatest fear is to ever be accused of bullying. Very hard to accuse a leader of being a bully when they have a reputation of being a caring leader who listens and supports and helps. And it's not in an organization's best interest to get rid of you because you're struggling with a mental health challenge, because they have to replace you and, you know, could be out of the frying pan into the fire. You know, those days are gone. I think they're hopefully they're behind us now, that an organization would victimize someone for having a mental health challenge. Mm-hmm. I would hate to think they still exist. Probably some old style leaders are, but organizations would be sort of more across it, I think. Mm. So yeah, it's a good conversation. It's never a difficult one. Don't be afraid of it. and it's okay to say, I don't know. It's okay to say, I don't know. Let's find out together.
Yeah. Listening to people. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's so underrated.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. We don't save or rescue anyone. And there are some positives to burnout, I think, as well.
Right.
Because it does, well, look, I think it does, I won't say forces us, but it certainly encourages us when we recognize that that's what's going on. It encourages us to sort of be introspective about what's important to us, to be innovative about how we think we might sort of deal with it. Reprioritize what's important to us. There's a number of different things that can come out of, and if you have a good conversation with your organization or with your leader, then you might find yourself very pleasantly surprised that because of some boundaries you set around what's important for your own self-care, that the business accommodates you, and now suddenly you are a happy, engaged employee.
Oh, that sounds fabulous.
Isn't it?
Yes. And I think that on that note, we will finish up the conversation. So fantastic. Thank you so much for that enlightening insight into you, your background and your journey and the choices that you've made and the incredible and important work that you've done, as well as some insights into burnout and the sorts of things that we can do to, you know, not let burnout be a forever situation, but there are a lot of important things you can do, and that focus on the positive and resetting and rethinking about what's important, absolutely critical. So thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you, Karen. You've been a hero of mine for some time. I've been looking forward to getting on here at some point. So I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks.